The dairy people learned early that it was hard to get people to come out to dairy meetings unless they furnished an entertainment of some kind, and so they developed the practice of writing and producing, I suppose, in a very informal manner, humorous sketches relating to local subjects and to farmers and their problems and whatnot. You can imagine how robust these often got and so forth. But they did the trick. People came to see their neighbors make fools of themselves, as they said, on the stage. And then they stayed for a serious discussion of the dairy problem afterward. And that's actually the way a lot of the problems were discussed and solved in the early dairy circles in Wisconsin. And the drama occupied a significant role in doing this. And in the cities, it was a more sophisticated kind of thing. The community theater movement had really gotten its roots down here with a remarkable professor of English named Thomas H. Dickinson, who was interested in teaching a course in American drama, and the English department would not allow him to do this because of their attachment to classical 18th, 19th century English literature chiefly, and they thought nothing was worth studying in America in those days, at least in dramatic literature, and I suspect that would have spilled over into any kind of literature here. They were pretty conservative. But Dickinson stuck with it, and he got finally, through writing a play which he got produced in New York, he convinced his colleagues to let him offer this course. And it went so well, the students were so interested, that he formed the Wisconsin Dramatic Society in Bascom Hall up here with his students and a few townspeople. And they began to produce plays. Zona Gale of Portage wrote the first play for them, which they produced, which was a long one-act called The Neighbors, which is still being played today.
My goodness.
And out of that kind of movement grew a will to establish a community theater movement in the state, and the people who were most interested were pretty well known about, and Dickinson began to make contact with them through a little publication called The Playbook, which he managed to publish a little magazine. And they put on plays, and they had a Milwaukee branch, and Laura Sherry, who became very well known, managed the Milwaukee branch of the Wisconsin Dramatic Society. And out of that grew a large interest in the state in local drama. And when I came here, I felt that Dickinson was long gone then. He went from here to Princeton or Harvard or someplace. That it would be very beneficial to have a conference or association of community theaters. And I started this in 1945. We had our first meeting in the Wisconsin Union, I remember, in the old Madison Room, and had a thoroughly delightful discussion, and we all felt the same way about things. And out of that, this conference grew into one of the really significant ones in the country, and I made friendships there that many of those people are gone now, but still exist to this day, although that conference is now called the Wisconsin Theater Association, and it is the largest in the United States. I didn't know anybody knew that or not. So lined us out on the theater side, and I used these community theaters as training centers for areas so that people could come in there and have a day of conferences on how to produce plays.
And this was done under the title of the Wisconsin Idea Theater?
Yeah, all of it was.
All of it was.
Then about the same time, a year or two later, I started a writer's movement called the Wisconsin Regional Writers Association, because I felt that this must go along hand in hand with the theater thing.
But was this to encourage people to write plays or to write other
to
things?
To write any kind of literature, although we had a strong playwriting bent. We encouraged them to write poetry, to write stories, to write essays, and even books. And it caught on really big right from the start.
How did you go about this?
Well, it started in a very minor way. One summer day, again in June, I was meeting with some people at Wakeland McNeil, who used to be head of the 4-H clubs in the state. He was, I don't know whether you remember him. He was widely known. They called him Ranger Mac, a most wonderful man.
I think Mr. Sorden talked about it.
Oh, I'm sure he did. And Mac wanted me to meet these people and talk to them about young people's drama. And so I spent a half a day in a classroom in Bascom Hall, I remember. And the conversation wasn't so much about drama as it was about general interpretation, literary interpretation. And some of these people thought that there could well be a young people's movement in this, and I thought, well, there certainly ought to be an adult movement, too. So I got thinking about it, and I simply chartered this group of 8 people as charter members of a thing and decided to call it the Wisconsin Regional Writers Association. That's the way that got started, when McNeil was very interested in it. And then I found that hundreds and hundreds of people, I got out a letter to many, many rural people. I suppose I got name lists from the College of Agriculture and from almost anybody I could. And we got 1,000 members the first brush within a semester. We had 1,000 members, and they were all writing.
My goodness, that's amazing.
It is, really. There was a hunger, especially among farm women, who were some semi-isolated. Wisconsin farms were in those days not as easily accessible as they are today. And women especially, and had been for a long time, had been having a sort of lonely life. Those who were creative at all, finding sympathetic companionship and conversation about these things. We knew that, and so that's one of the things that we wanted to come at in this Writers Association. I was fortunate enough to make close connections with a retired school teacher from Wisconsin Dells named Fidelia Van Antwerp, a Belgian name. She was a really great woman at that time. I suppose she was between 65 and 70 years old. And she said to me, she said, "This sounds so interesting. I've been a teacher all my life. I don't want to give up having something to do." And she said, "How about letting me take on this regional writers, as we call it, the Rural Writers Association in those days, and see what I can do with it." I said, "I think that's just marvelous." So she became my right-hand lieutenant in all of this. She spent practically every dime of her own money in traveling around the state. We didn't have any travel funds then. And she made contact with the local groups, established local writers groups, until she had 40 or 50 of these local writers associations located at Fond du Lac, or located at a place like Frederick in northern Wisconsin, or Wisconsin Dells, or in the Janesville area. Didn't make any difference.
Sort of all over the state.
All over. And this movement got down such deep roots and was so sentimentally regarded that I'd have to say that it's probably the best thing I ever did in the the state. It is still going on today at about the same level, and which is quite something when you think of that many years and people meeting twice a year and having all these local meetings and carrying on a round robin letter to these isolated farm people who get this letter and add their own writing to it and send it on to the next one. It's really a very heartening thing to do.
Does some of this material get published?
Oh yeah, it's been published by the Yard. We used to have a magazine called Creative Wisconsin, which we kept going until we ran out of any assets to publish it. That's what's happened here over the years. But these great ideas, which could be started so cheaply in their inception, grew more and more expensive for the university to operate or to supervise. And so much of this got turned back to the people themselves to operate and finance. And in that way, I suppose it suffered some decline.
Lost
some impetus, but not entirely. And there were innumerable projects that I was highly interested and motivated in starting here, such as the Small Community in the Arts program, for which we got the first large grant that the National Endowment for the Arts made for this kind of work. They were making, in their first year or two, they were making large grants to the New York Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera, Cleveland Orchestra or something like that, but they were making none to the bulk of the people in the country and in the places where they live. I got $260,000 from them to start a program in the rural and small communities on an experimental basis. And this occupied me for 5 or 6 years. It was a matching grant, and I had to match it. Hate to tell you, I got the money to match it.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
I can't remember. I know that it caused some worry among our administrators as to whether we could do it, but we did do it.
How is this program doing now? Is it
the one we were just talking about?
Yes.
The hangover has been remarkable, and the whole country benefited a great deal from this. We published a book called The Small Community in the Arts, which we distributed over 20,000 all over the United States. And this has had a profound effect in getting new work started in almost every state. One of the specimen kinds of things is what we call the Yarns of Yesteryear, which is a program for people above 60 years old who write reminiscences about their boyhood or girlhood. And this has been just so popular in the state. We have hundreds and hundreds, and we have to keep a full-time person here really to handle
Is this a radio program?
It's been on the radio many times. Clarice Dunn broadcasts regularly reading some of this material. Yeah, we've been on WHA quite a while. That's another thing I did when I first came here. I started a radio program on WHA in which I wrote a play a week, a half-hour play a week called Wisconsin Yarns, which was very popular. I kept it going as long as I could.
Play a week?
I ran out of steam after about
three or four years.
That's
pretty demanding.
Oh, you can't believe how hard I worked in those years. So that's the general run of the story, Donna. There are all kinds of fill-ins that you could make in it.
Well, I'm all for the fill-ins.
A lot of this fill-in material is in is in a book or two of mine. I guess I don't even have a copy of Grassroots Theater here. That's another aspect of my work here, which has been very important to me, has been the writing of many books about the state and adjacent subjects. And these books have mounted up to a total of nearly 40 now, I suppose. Some of them have been very good, well-received, good sellers, and highly appreciated in the state. And I have always felt that the native literature was a very needful thing. I've done such things as this book called Romance of Wisconsin Place Names, which I did with my friend Leland Sorden. And I collected, I say I because actually I did most of the work on it. I collected a good many, almost, well, not all, because that would be impossible, but a good many of the place names of Wisconsin, and put them together with the source material as to how they received their names in this very interesting book called Place Names in Wisconsin, which has been widely appreciated, widely sold throughout the state. I've tried to do that kind of thing because I think it has strengthened the whole idea of a native approach to literature. And while my interest has not been exclusively to any extent, well, to some extent, but not to exclusion, the rural areas, I have been very interested in the small community or the smaller community in the rural areas because I felt that that is where the work most needed to be done. And I think that partly, I have to take part credit for it, that Wisconsin, without doubt, today is the leading grassroots state in the United States as far as its interest in cultural work at the local level or the community level. And to keep that sort of thing foremost, as you know, the Robert E. Gard Wisconsin Idea Foundation has been established with headquarters at Spring Green. Spring Green has always been a kind of a informal capital of my country work, partly because I've grown so close to the people out there, particularly those south of the Wisconsin River.
And, I was going to get to that.
We have great hopes that eventually we'll be able to interest significantly. Well, what would you like to know?
Well, briefly, perhaps, I'd like to go into some of the specific activities. So, for instance, what went on during the centennial celebration?
Oh, yes. When I came here in 1945, there was already major talk about the coming Wisconsin State Centennial. Wisconsin was made a state, if I can remember my date correctly, on May 29th, 1848. May 29th, 1848. I'm sure it was, but I'm right about that. And already they were beginning to appoint committees and get ready to make a big splash and show in honor of the state. In 1948, and there were remarkable people still on the scene at that time. I grew very fond and very close to some of them. There was, if you just bide with me so that I can get my memory focused and give you some of these names. Ora Rice, who was a state legislator from Delavan, I believe, a farmer down there, was state chairman of the Centennial Committee. Appointed probably by Governor Goodman. I think I'm right about that. Was Goodman governor in 1945? I think he was.
Around about then, I think.
I think he was still governor in 1945. He was succeeded by Rennebaum, wasn't he? So it must have been Goodman that appointed Orr Rice. Senator Robinson from Beloit was a very strong figure. He and I were very good friends, and he was interested in the drama. And then there was a group in Madison, which was chiefly headed by Albert Gallistel. I don't know whether you remember him. Albert was head of Building and Grounds, as they called it in those days. Wonderful older man, and he was so interested in pageantry and all that stuff. He was chiefly representing the university. Frank Holt, who was at that time, I believe, had been or still was head of University Extension, one of the popular men in Wisconsin, was on the committee. Milo Swanton, who's still living, by the way, he's in his early 90s now, was head of the Agricultural Committee, I remember. And President Fred was president of the university. And I was appointed chairman for drama of the state centennial, I remember. And Vera Dogan, Dougan, was appointed the state chairman for the arts. Vera was a very attractive woman, a farm woman who lived near Beloit. And my work at WHA was very much connected with this. But my chief assignment was to write a state centennial pageant. I guess you'd call it a pageant. I didn't call it a pageant. I just called it I forget what I did call it. It wasn't a pageant. To be performed in Camp Randall. And as time went on, I worked very hard on all of these things. I was on the Central Committee for the Centennial. We arranged a massive parade. It's probably the biggest parade that's ever been seen in the city of Madison. It took place on the 29th of May. And following the parade on that day, we had the celebration in Camp Randall. And I think it's the only time that I know of that Camp Randall Stadium has ever been virtually filled except for a football game.
Oh.
It was a huge crowd. We had built a great stand, you know, where the field house is, in the front of the field stand, very high up. How they built it so high, I don't know. It was hazardous getting up to it. We had a great choir located up on this high platform, which had to be 40 or 50 feet up from ground level, up where everybody could see it. And this was a night thing. We had a stage located in the middle of the football field. There we had all kinds of high-powered lighting equipment, and we borrowed and rented all we could get because it took a lot of light to light that whole scene there. And we had Carl Schmidt, you probably know, from WHA now, was our narrator. And he did the narration Jadon Vigley, who composes still for WHA and for National Broadcasting, composed the music. I wrote the words. And it was, I think, a beautiful show. I can't remember an awful lot about it, and unfortunately, I cannot find the script of it.
That's a loss.
It's a loss. I don't know where the scripts went. We had scripts, and there may be one over in the university archives. I've never gone specifically to look for it, but I wouldn't be surprised. But Vigley's music was very good. He had an orchestra. He directed the orchestra. We had the governor, who was Rennebaum then, and I remember that Governor Rennebaum got tangled up in electrical cables on the stage and couldn't extract himself. He was out there, and we more or less had to be carried off of the stage. But he said something to the people. I don't know what it was. I don't know whether he even knew what it was. It was a gala night, and for weeks and weeks afterward, I got letters and testimonials and things about that, which I suppose are lying over in the archives somewhere, I don't know. Anyway, it was a success, but one of the toughest assignments that I ever undertook. There was so much about the state you wanted to tell, and the people, and subsequent to that, I remember, and I'm sure it was partly a result of it, my relations with the athletic department in those days, and still, are very good, and they always sort of let me do whatever I wanted to. After all, the stadium wasn't used much during the year. And so we started musical shows out there, David Peterson and I. And every week we would have either an original or a commercial musical performed in the stadium. We used, see, which side? I believe it would have been the north side, wouldn't it? The side that's under the press box. Which side is that?
Is that the west side?
Is that the west, or is that must be the west? That's not the north side, is it? Well, is it the north? Well, anyway, we found when we first started, we had these things in around the horseshoe where. And we found that in that location, strangely enough, like in some of the old Greek theaters in ancient Greece, that the acoustics were awfully good. You could stand down there at the foot of the concrete seats and speak in a normal tone, and you could be heard way back up. And we didn't know that, but there's something about that kind of thing that was very good. So I don't think we even had to use amplification, as I remember. Well, we did these musicals, and then I started the program of bringing ethnic groups, dancing and singing groups from Milwaukee and other places in the state. We brought Welsh people over from Cambria and the Randolph area and the La Crosse area, and we brought Norwegians. We brought French down from Somerset and all those places where they have performing groups, Cedarburg, and there's Lodge Holland element over there, and people who dance in wooden shoes. We brought the Klumpen dancers over, I remember. And this was very, very popular here. They didn't fill the stadium as they did for the centennial, but there were a significant number of people came to. You know, you can lose 20,000 people in there and hardly know that they're in there.
That's
at all.
True.
So we drew. That was a good success. And
these people brought their own productions. Mm-hmm.
They
the
did.
Ones that they had
we put them together with a narration, and just put them on, that's all.
How long a period of time did this go on?
Oh, that went on for a number of years, and I can't remember. David maybe would be able to tell you. We, when we'd get rained out, we'd simply move into the field house. It wasn't as good in there, but it was okay. And it was very cheap for us to do. The athletic department didn't charge us anything. I think we had to pay some of the men who helped us set up the stage and manage the ticket gates and this kind of thing, but it was inexpensive. In those days, I was based in the College of Agriculture, and I think we made considerable money out of those, but I can't remember how much it was now. I probably still have around the counters I did it in. I know they're here somewhere, which we used at the ticket gates to count the people as they came in. I've got 4 or 5.
You touched last time on the National Endowment for the Arts, but you didn't go into much detail about it, and I was wondering if you could give me some of the background.
Sure. The National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities were in the talking stage for a long, long while. Congress was in and out of this. The whole question of federal support for the arts received a blow, I suppose you could call it, in the 1930s, late 1930s particularly, when the Federal Theater and the Federal Art Project got somehow in the popular mind or in the congressional mind tinged with the threat of communism. And it was this often erroneous, I think for the most part, erroneous interpretation of those programs which ultimately caused what they called the blacklisting of many artists and many writers and many motion picture people and actors throughout the country.
What reason was there?
Well, there wasn't any real reason except that popular programs of that kind, which are particularly seemingly those related to the arts, seem to be suspect. They deal almost inevitably with a clientele of applicants and recipients who are of a highly impoverished nature. These people never have any money, or in those days they particularly didn't have any money, and made themselves quite vocal. Some said uncomplimentary things about the federal government, and in any case, the very conservative people in Congress were always and always have been suspicious of support or subsidy programs, particularly where the arts are concerned. I guess you could put it as simply as that. And then, as it went on, and you got a person like Joe McCarthy coming into the picture, who made a celebrated cause out of ferreting out what he called communists in the arts and in the theater and so forth, then it began to get very, very tough. And many, many kinds of things, including freedom of expression and so forth, came into it at that time. And I think that this is when so many people got on lists which later on were extremely damaging to them when they began to try to seek employments and whatnot. In other words, it was hard for them to get jobs.
groups when their names were on certain lists, and very often these were on completely unjustifiably. I know that there was a woman in New York named Elizabeth Dilling. I don't know whether you remember the name or not. She was a leader of the pack of hounds that were trying to find evidences of communism in different parts of the society. And one of her targets, which was absurd, was the Rockefeller Foundation. She thought the Rockefeller Foundation was riven through with communists and so forth, whereas old John D. Rockefeller the First couldn't have been further.
Always considered them fairly conservative.
And it was absurd. But anyway, I was a fellow of the Rockefeller Foundation at that time, and actually, she got me onto one of those lists of people at Cornell University who were connected with the Rockefeller Foundation. Ergo, I was a communist and so forth. It never caused me any trouble or that I knew about. Well, anyway, this gained in favor over the years, this movement of federal support for the arts. Some very strong people took up the cudgels, including Senator Javits of New York State, who was influential in Congress, and other people got very interested in it, several foundations threw their weight behind it. And of course there were constant pressures applied by the big performing arts organizations such as the Metropolitan in New York, the New York Symphony, the Boston Symphony, and so forth, to get some federal subsidies for their programs. Well, this was an in and out kind of thing, but it did begin to gel until in 1965 Congress passed the first enabling legislation to establish the National Endowments for the Arts and the Humanities. They established two foundations, one for arts and one for humanities, which still continue to this day. There was not, at the beginning, very much money attached to these. It was a petty amount of money, but it was the first time that the federal government had made an official gesture outside of what Franklin Roosevelt did when he established the Federal Theater as a welfare program to support the arts. The National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities was not a welfare program. It was direct support to the arts on application by worthy groups and individuals. There was a National Council on the Arts established, and I believe that this must have been originally established by John Kennedy, and then after the legislation it would have been Johnson and his administration who were instrumental in carrying this on. The first chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts was a remarkable man named Roger Stevens, who was a real estate dealer, actually. That was chiefly where he made his money. At one time, he owned the Empire State Building. Among other things, he was well-to-do, or at least he had a lot of property in his name. I don't know how well-to-do he was. He became the first national chairman, and I'd have to say he was a very good one. He was a shrewd businessman, and he was able to win congressional supports of different kinds. And this was all under Democratic administration, of course, and so you have to give a good bit of the of the credit to the Democrats on this. On the other hand, a lot of Republican senators and congressmen were backing it as well. I got into to this picture real early because I had developed the idea that a large proportion of the American population still lived in communities under 10,000. And it wasn't until I examined the United States Census of 1960 that I did this over in the Agricultural College in the Department of Rural Sociology. I didn't realize how many people there were in America who were living in these smaller places, over 66 million at that time.
More than you'd anticipated.
Oh, yes. And I immediately was struck by the fact that this huge proportion of the American population was receiving no attention whatever from the federal government. Their focus, I knew, would be toward the large metropolitan arts organizations, and they would cream off the bulk of whatever money there was. So I had a good friend who had become, in the meantime, after our association for nearly 15 years, his name was Charles Mark, M-A-R-K, and he became a confidant of Roger Stevens, and Roger Stevens hired him as his chief assistant. Well, Charles came out here. He was a Wisconsin graduate, and I'd known him for a long time, and he and I were talking about this. He said, gee, that's a wonderful idea. He said, why don't you submit a grant application in behalf of small communities and the arts in America? Never been done before. So I got some, in those days, pretty amateur but capable help. Nobody knew much about writing these grants then. And we hacked out a grant on this subject, which we sent in to the National Council for the Arts. Strangely enough, it received a magnificently warm reception. And people like Isaac Stern, who was on the council, and Leonard Bernstein. Chuck Mark now says Leonard Bernstein had the most to do with its passage. And a group of other people who opposed it because they could see that they didn't want this this kind of grassroots stuff to get started draining off money from what they wanted to do with big city arts development. So the thing was in the mill for a while, and suddenly I got a call from Charles Mark. He said, they've passed your application. It was for $250,000. That was a big one in those days. And related to the total amount of money that the National Endowment had then, it was a pretty good chunk of it. We got the first grant of that kind in the United States. We immediately made plans to choose five experimental communities in Wisconsin, which we'd test to see what, and set up some controls so that we could see what had been going on there and what they needed and how they could best be aided with stimulating grants to improve their facilities, train leadership, and this kind of much needed work.
What kind of controls did you set up?
Well, for example, for this community of Spring Green, we set up a control at Mazelmany and so forth. And we had ostensibly a control group for each one of these, which we compared. We did nothing in one. We did other things in another one. And
well, you did something in Spring Green, but not in Mazelmany?
Not in Mazelmany. And Then we ran a research survey later on to see what had been the results of those things. Well, these did work really remarkably well. We had our difficulties, and there was some jealousy over who was going to get the money and so forth. But for the most part, it worked very well. I think in the case of Spring Green, we overdid it just a bit and probably brought more high-powered talent into the community than the community was ready for at the moment. They'd already had Frank Lloyd Wright. And Frank Lloyd Wright was never popular in Spring Green, so we started under a cloud in a sense there. You said anything about the arts, or, well, what's this going to have to do with Taliesin or Frank Lloyd Wright? They shut up right then, you know, but we overcame that to an extent.
But you weren't, of course, associated
with that. No, not at all, but the stigma of those things does hang over. And so we worked there and worked very hard. I did a number of very unusual things. We had an old theater opera house in the village, which we had remodeled. And we put the Milwaukee Repertory into this village for a summer to see what really high-level theater would do for the village. It didn't do anything for them. In fact, they resented it. They resented the strangers coming in. They thought they were just bringing dope and things to their young people and corrupting the morals of the place. I brought such people as Lee Strasberg and Boris Goldovsky, and others I can't remember even who they were, who were very well known nationally. Lee Strasberg had an acting class, if you can believe it, in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Goldovsky trained people in opera out at that little Wyoming Valley Frank Lloyd Wright schoolhouse, which worked pretty well for that. We did all kinds of, we had built an amphitheater up on Highway 23, and we had local musicals playing a good many nights during a month in there. That was long before the American Players ever dreamed of theater. We had a pretty good amphitheater and a stage up there, now gone completely to pot. And there was an Uplands Arts Council that we formed, and it has some relationship to the Guard Foundation at Aldebaran today. Then other communities were Waupun. We chose that for various reasons. Portage was one, Rhinelander was one, Adams Friendship was the other one. We had five altogether, all different. And I'd have to say that if you go into those communities today and ask whether anything happened during those 1960s years that is influential in their life today, a few people in every community will tell you, yes, for goodness sake, we couldn't have done this or this or this, or we have a nice place to perform, or we have an art gallery now, which never would have been if this hadn't been done, and so forth and so on.
Well, I have the idea that they were suspicious to start with.
Some of them.
Some places.
We had a good deal of contact with Washington on this. They were watching it like an eagle, partly because they sensed, Roger Stevens sensed, that this kind of grassroots movement might be very good to gain congressional support, and especially the House of Representatives.
Oh.
So I went to Washington several times to hearings and this kind of thing, and told our story there. It got into the congressional record, and so it was a pretty well-known thing. Unfortunately, the big money people eventually won out, as they always do in this, and we were never able to get much continuation. We got one small supplemental grant.
That's a pity.
But if they had kept on with that and kept their nose to the grindstone, but again, it got tinged with politics, and not from our point of view, but in Washington, they thought that certain people were playing political chess with these things. And so that's about the story of that. It was a worthwhile thing to do. We had to match this money. I remember I was in Chapel Hill one weekend, and I got a frantic call from Don McNeil, who was then the Chancellor of Extension. He said, "Bob, we've got to match $250,000. How are you going to do it?" I said, "Don, I don't know, but we'll find some ways to do it." And I did. The communities, well, here the communities were very cooperative. Rhinelander, for example, we had been using for 3 or 4 years for the Rhinelander School, using all of their most expensive school buildings up there, and they never charged us a dime for it. And I went to their Board of Education and simply asked them if they didn't think that $10,000 to $20,000 summer rental was a fair rental for the major high school and the junior high and so forth that we were using. And they said, "You know what we would be charging if we were charging somebody that we didn't," and they told me. So we were able, through their town council and so forth, to put that kind of an item of expense in as matching funds. We didn't have to pay any money, but the government accepted that.
They were providing that equivalent of that kind of expense.
And then all the communities pitched in and found things that they were contributing that qualified as matching money. And then I was able to put a percentage of my own time into this. We did it. We matched.
You did it.
We matched the money. Nobody was ever unhappy about it. And I must say that our relationships with the financial people at the university were excellent. We never had any difficulties. And I don't know. I think my own reputation in Washington suffered a little bit because of this. I had some associates who were very, very vocal and very antagonistic, in a sense. They thought the government ought to be doing more, and so they would, unknown to me, write rather sharp letters to people in Washington, critical of their management of the National Endowment, and this did me no good at all, I can assure you.
I'm sure it couldn't have.
As a matter of fact, one of the people who was guilty of that had vast difficulties finding employment thereafter. He finally did get a job in Tucson, Arizona. But he was a talented man, but he was just too unwise in what he said. Among other people he wrote constantly to was Senator Proxmire, and you know what Senator Proxmire would do with that kind of, he'd fire that on to the people in the chairmans of the committee. He was probably after them himself. This didn't help us at all, and I think that was one thing that caused us not to get repeat grants. If I had that to do over, I'd know many things to do with it that I don't know now. One of the interesting things that happened in connection with that grant was a visitation to Madison and Spring Green by Lady Bird Johnson, who came with a retinue of people, including 3 cabinet members.
Oh.
And the National Endowment for the Arts chairman, Roger Stevens. They were all here.
Do you recall which cabinet members they were?
Orville Freeman was one, and seems like the Secretary of the Interior, I don't remember who that was at the time, Roger Stevens, and I think there was one other, I can't recall. But we entertained them at Spring Green, and that's the occasion on which the Spring Green restaurant was opened. We opened it for Lady Bird Johnson that night. She arrived there still laying grass and stones around on the patio within a half hour of her arrival. We had a great night. There was a glittering crowd there for dinner. We had both of our senators there, our three or four congressmen. We had all of Lady Bird Johnson's retinue and maybe a dozen security people, civil service, gun-toting kinds of people who watched us like a hawk all the time. And then we took them into the village of Spring Green for a show at the theater. And we had such a crowd in the streets that I was supposed to sit with Mrs. Johnson that night. I couldn't get through the crowd. I just couldn't make my way to the front door of the theater. I had to make a huge circuit around through fields and backyards to the back door of the theater and go through and come out the front door in order to find her out in front. And it was that kind of a night. It was a great night. It's never been written up, really. Somebody ought to, because so many funny things happened.
Can you give me any examples?
Well, one thing that happened was a farm woman named Mrs. Johnson. Her name was Mrs. Johnson, too. And she was very uppity about the president's wife. With her money and her uppity ways, coming out to see how the poor rural people were living. But you know, she was magnificent. She wouldn't change her shoes or anything like that.
She wouldn't dress up in
No, she got into the national press for not doing this. Got a lot of, I saw this written up in all Eastern papers and everything. And she met president's wife in an old pair of manure-stained tennis shoes and whatnot, and escorted her on a trip through their dairy barn. And I'd have to say that Lady Bird Johnson was a perfect lady. She responded magnificently to this kind of thing, and she should have been the politician, I think, rather than her husband, because she had all kinds of stuff to offer, including a very attractive woman. And I sat with her during the theater and had a nice visit with her. Matter of fact, that picture up there, the picture of me with Lady Bird Johnson that night as we're going into the theater.
Oh, yes, that's nice.
Yeah. That's the kind of thing that was. It was just another. I worked terribly hard. I don't know whether you know, Donna. No doubt other people have told you the same thing, the administration of large federal monies is a tough, tough thing to do. You have to watch your P's and Q's every step of the way.
Well, that's a good thing, don't you believe?
I do, and I had good help in order to do that. I hired two or three young assistants who were good at that kind of thing. They kept us out of trouble.
I'm glad to hear that.
Not a cent of that money went for anything except what it was supposed to go for. Well, that's about all I know about that. What else do you want to know?
Well, that's quite a bit. Well, you might tell me a little bit more about the Spring Green Theater.
Spring Green Theater was an old theatrical house. It had been there for quite a while. It burned, I believe, in the 1890s or early years of this century. It was rebuilt. And when in the 60s had fallen into great disrepair, hadn't been used for a good while. I think during the 20s it was used as a movie house. It's a jewel of a theater. It's got brass medallions on the ceiling. It seats 300 people. It's got a little tiny balcony in it, and it's got a raked floor, and everything is just right for a small country theater. Robert Graves, who lives in the Spring Green area and now manages all of those enterprises, called the Spring Green Restaurant, the Winter Green Ski Hill, and the Springs Golf Course, and so forth, are all under his management. A very strong and energetic man in those days, almost unbelievably strong. He almost single-handedly remodeled that theater, painted the gold medallions lying on his back on a scaffold and all that kind of thing. And he never really got local credit, and people were suspicious of him and thought he was trying to promote his own interests and whatnot. But that wasn't true.
Did they, when they did this, did they make an effort to put it back the way it had been, or did they?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. And we got, well, we had many volunteers who came and worked on that place. I worked many days on it. We painted it all, painted everything, and did a little plumbing. And when we finally opened it, it would look pretty good. And then Graves wanted to name it the Guard Theater, I suppose, because of the grant and what we were trying to do out there. And that name has stuck. It's still called the Guard Theater.
Oh, that's pretty nice.
And so I don't do much with it anymore. Helen O'Brien here, though, for
Helen O'Brien?
For many years has directed plays in there. She's been on our staff here, you know. She just retired. She's a good, very good play director, and excellent with community people. She made a very good community-based theater out of that, which I was very proud of, still am. That's about all I know about that. It is, in a sense, open to the public. You can get in to see it if you want to, but it's not open every day.
I've been to Spring Green, but I haven't happened to be in the theater.
Yeah.